This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and welcome to In Context. This is the new live version of History Counts, which has been broadcast at this time in the past. My name's Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Condovero.
Good evening.
And we're today's program, we're going to continue a discussion we began on our show this past Wednesday night when we focused on why the World Trade Center collapsed on 9/11. And we have a special guest who's been working on 9/11 issues who will be joining us on the phone in a few minutes. We'd also like to invite you listeners to join us by calling in during the program, and we'll be giving out the phone number a little bit later. For those of you who may not have heard our last program, here's a little review of the 9/11 facts. The World Trade Center's North Tower was struck by a Boeing 767 at 8:46 a.m. and completely collapsed in less than 2 hours. The South Tower was struck by another Boeing 767 at 9:03 a.m. and collapsed less than 1 hour later. 2,752 people died in the collapse of these two 110-story skyscrapers. Later that day at 5:30 p.m., World Trade Center Building Number 7, which was 47 stories tall, also completely collapsed, though it had not been struck by a plane. In the years since 9/11, numerous scholars have examined the available scientific data of the collapse to understand why the Twin Towers in Building 7 fell down. Many of them, including over 1,000 members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, concluded that the buildings did not collapse from the impact of the planes and subsequent fires. They collapsed, they believe, as the result of a controlled demolition involving explosives placed inside the buildings. And they've called for a new 9/11 investigation. Gus, could you please review for the listeners some of the reasons why these experts came to the conclusion that a controlled demolition destroyed the World Trade Center?
Absolutely. Some of the main points that have been discussed amongst all the peer-reviewed experts and all the documentary makers and the filmmakers, activists, they have talked about the vertical symmetrical free fall, the pulverization of the building material, the squibs visible on videos that appeared repeatedly coming laterally from the buildings just below the collapse line. And a listener last week actually asked me specifically what a squib was, because we talked about it a number of times but never actually described what a squib is. And that is building material that is forced out of the building in almost like a miniature explosion. And that's an indicator of when you have a charge placed on a column inside the building. When that goes off, it's going to throw out a little plume of compressed dust and debris. And the ones at the World Trade Center site were seen coming out they're calculated at 200 feet per second.
And these were coming out, as you could see in the video, just below the collapse line as the buildings came down.
So as it was going down, they were seen 60 feet, and another one that was about 120 feet, I think, below the collapse lines. And they came out at the exact same moment. So as the building was coming down, because as you know, there are dozens of videos that were taken at the day on the day of 9/11 of the collapse as it came down. You know, there are some that are far away. There are some that are actually below the building as it's coming down, only a block away. So it's practically looking straight up at the building because, you know, so tall. If you're a block away, you're practically looking up.
So in the controlled demolition scenario, these squibs represent cutter charges going off, taking out key supporting columns in a synchronized fashion so that all the resistance would be removed in the building.
Because the idea was that the pancaking of the official story is that the floors pancaked as they were going down. They explained, well, these squibs are blown out as the floors are compressing. But how could they have compressed simultaneously 25 floors, 40 floors apart?
And this also goes to the pulverization of the building material, because if the building were falling down because of the fire, you'd have large chunks of concrete and steel, which you didn't have. Some of the other factors?
There were witnesses, including 118 firemen, who heard several explosions and saw flashes. And we have clips of those. I don't know if we're going to get to them tonight, but we will definitely be playing those on the 11th on the 6 to 9 a.m. show. And clouds of pyroclastic concrete powder moving in all directions from the buildings, and that's seen only in places such as a active volcano or a building demolition, and with an explosion that would cause the concrete to completely pulverize and then cause these pyroclastic clouds as everything is falling down. The temperature, the fire, was estimated at between 1,200 and 1,600 degrees versus the melting and weakening points of steel. Melting point of steel is 2,750. And we did see molten steel at the site during the collapse and after the collapse. The presence of molten steel was in the grounds for weeks after the collapse and was reported there by many of the first responders and the workers during the cleanup crew. There's been no precedent for skyscrapers collapsing to fire, and the Meridian Plaza in Philadelphia in 1991 burned for 18 hours and did not fail. And there's been other buildings that were towering infernos, and they did not have any serious. The structure of the building remained afterward.
So again, and this has never happened. You've never had a complete failure
exactly.
of a steel frame skyscraper. And on this day, presumably three came down in this.
Three of the first, all on the same day.
Now, I spoke to Stephen Jones, who wrote the first, I think, really important scientific paper called
right.
Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Collapse? We uh-huh. had him on the show back in 2006. And back then, Professor Jones said he thought that the evidence that he analyzed compelled the conclusion that a controlled demolition was used, and that he believed that probably it involved an incendiary known as thermite, which mm-hmm. is sometimes used by the military to bring down metal structures. And he confirmed his suspicion that thermite was used, which was supported soon thereafter when he had the opportunity to analyze some formerly molten metal from the World Trade Center
right.
contained in a piece of slag. And he found very unusual elements, manganese and fluorine, which were consistent with the presence of super thermite. And then
correct.
A couple of years after that, he was part of an international team of scientists that used the latest X-ray spectroscopes to analyze the material in 4 samples of World Trade Center dust. And they, in fact, discovered unreacted super thermite in each of these 4 samples of World Trade Center
right.
dust.
Yeah. Some of the samples were collected from the scene of the collapse and from places like in a woman's apartment apartment who faced the World Trade Center. Her windows were blown in and a lot of the dust came in, and then she was able to collect a complete an independent sample that way. And there was four samples, right?
There were
that were collected.
Samples.
And then despicably, all the steel was trucked out of the site without allowing any independent examinations. It was sent to China and melted down. It was used for things like the battleship that they just did a little
bit. Is that right?
The USS New York.
And there were experts.
Which is like a backhanded insult, you know, like the whole.
That's right. They sent it to China. But, of course, it was totally not in accord with accepted procedures for how you would investigate
right.
a case of arson such as this. And the procedures that were applied at the time were denounced by leading experts like Bill Manning, the editor-in-chief of one of the leading fire science journals in America.
And the trucking companies that were used, I think there was 3 or 4 trucking companies that were used to take away all the steel samples from the site is one of them. They had such tight oversight that one of the truck drivers took a long lunch break, and they had GPS units on all the trucks to make sure that they didn't make any stops that were unapproved. One of the guys took a long lunch break and he was permanently dismissed from the job. So it shows that they were so concerned that outside investigators would get a hold of some of these steel samples to find out what was on them.
It's quite incredible. And what adds to the incredible nature of it is this nanothermite, which was discovered in the World Trade Center dust, was developed by the United States government in the mm-hmm. 1990s. It's a state-of-the-art incendiary explosive. And at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and other federal research facilities, and this incendiary was manufactured in a liquid form, which can be applied to surfaces with a spray or a paintbrush. So
right.
it's a very practical and
it's very versatile.
Very versatile and advanced explosive. So if you just tuned in, this is Ken McDermott and Gus Condovaro, and you're listening to In Context, the new live version of History Counts. We're broadcasting from WPKN at 89.5 FM in Bridgeport and streaming live on WPKN.org. And we're discussing the reasons for the collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11. We have a guest coming up shortly.
That's right. It's Luke Radowski, and he is influential in starting the activist group We Are Change in New York City. And we're going to be speaking to him in a few minutes about some of the events coming up and some of the issues that he's involved with.
Well, shall we take a short musical break? A short break.
We heard the noise,
and we'll be back
with
Luke.
An implosion.
Secondary explosion on Tower 2.
Some sort of explosive device.
We're obviously having a bit of trouble right now maintaining our location because we just heard one more explosion.
There was another major explosion.
Do you know anything about those extra explosions we heard?
No, I do not.
Were they car bombs?
I have no idea, ma'am.
The string shook, and I heard like an explosion.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse? To me, it sounded like an explosion.
We heard a very loud blast, an explosion.
They were taking photographs and securing this area just prior to that huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
Not clear now is why this explosion took place.
When there was some sort of collapse or explosion.
From street level, as though it had exploded up, a giant rolling ball of flame, and the firefighters screamed, run.
It was this blast of warm air. It wasn't hot. It was warm. And it picked me up and threw me up against the wall of the building I was.
You were picked up off the ground.
Physically picked up off the ground.
I remember an explosion. At that point, I got knocked out. I don't remember anything. Then I got up, and I looked out the window because the windows exploded, and the street below caved in. And at that point, there was like fireballs coming up.
An hour later than that, we had that big explosion from much, much lower. I don't know what on earth caused that.
15 minutes after they made their entry, we heard a boom. I don't know if that was the infrastructure that was going or another explosion.
Again, there has been a second explosion.
John, just seconds ago, there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
All of a sudden, I heard rumbling, and we all started running away from it. The glass, like, blew out and threw me onto the sidewalk, and I couldn't see for, like, 20 seconds.
It was like holy hell coming down them stairs. And then when we finally got to the bottom, we were coming out on a mezzanine level there. And another explosion came right on me, just everyone flying.
We stuck on the stairs for a while. We finally got down to the lobby. Then we get to the lobby, it was this big explosion.
So I was real lucky. I don't know what happened to the people behind me when that blast occurred.
And it was actually on the 78th floor of the second tower. And was evacuating the tower and experienced all these explosions and made his way back down.
We presume because of the initial explosion, there may have been secondary explosions as well that were detonated in the building by these terrorists.
There was a secondary explosion, probably a device either planted before or on the aircraft that did not explode until an hour later.
I heard a second explosion and another rumble and more smoke and more dust. I ran inside the buildings, the chandelier shook, and again, black smoke filled the air. Within another 5 minutes, we were covered again with more silt and more dust. And then a fire marshal came in and said we had to leave because if there was a third explosion, this building might not last.
And we're back. And what you just heard was a compilation of audio clips of eyewitness and interviews from the moments following the attacks on 9/11 when the planes crashed into the buildings. And you hear all the people who they interviewed spoke about one theme that ran through all of them, and it was explosions. It was pops. It was blasts. Every single person whose first reaction was, "I heard an explosion." To be clear, they weren't talking about the plane crashing into the building and exploding. They weren't talking about the sound of the crushing floors and the steel and the concrete crashing down through themselves. It was specifically individual sounds. And I have other clips that we may get to here where the theories immediately following the collapse was that there were bombs in the building. And that was the official investigation on that day. They seemed to initially get it right out of the gate. It was the FBI thinks that there's bombs in the building. And Dave, if we could play track two on that CD. This is Jack Kelly from the USA Today being interviewed, and he's following a lead where the FBI believes that there are bombs in the building.
Joining me is Jack Kelly. Now, he is a foreign correspondent. He has some information about these attacks. Jack, what can you tell us happened first in New York?
Apparently, what appears to happen was that at the same time two planes hit the building, that the FBI most likely thinks that there was a car or truck packed with explosives underneath the buildings, which also exploded at the same time and brought both of them down.
Now, that's the first time we're hearing that. So two planes and explosives that were in the building, is that correct?
That is the working theory at this point. That is still unconfirmed, but that is what the FBI is going on.
Yet more initial reaction of explosions and bombs, because they're going off of what they saw and what they heard. And what they heard and saw was very compelling, because the next clip is taken from Richard Gage's Blueprint for 9/11 Truth. Richard Gage is one of the leaders of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And they've done a very credible and extensive examination of the building's performance during the attacks and the ensuing collapse and the way the debris was formed afterwards and the steel and everything. It's really tremendous. They have two versions. They have a 2-hour version, right?
Right. And you can see it on YouTube.
And a 30-minute short version if you just don't have two hours to sit through that. But in the presentation, which they go through a number of points on there, which is, you know, they describe a controlled demolition and they list all of the points necessary to say that this, yes, is a controlled demolition, and they compare it to the World Trade Center building collapses, and they give you a checklist of how many of those things are present within those collapses, and they talk about present visible and audible sounds of chain reaction charges. And this next one, Dave, is going to be track 3, and they're playing an interview from somebody who was at World Trade Center 7 and his immediate reaction and description of the chain reaction explosion going on in Building 7.
Now, let's take a look at the evidence of World Trade Center 7 and see how it stacks up against the typical features of a controlled demolition, starting with, is there a sudden onset of destruction? Let's listen to this emergency word.
We were watching the building, actually, because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire, and, you know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was, well, it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. Then, you know, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground.
A sound of a clap of thunder, a shock wave ripping through the building, and windows busting out, and then the building coming down.
So that is another reaction of somebody, and he said that there's a shockwave through the building. And the NIST's official story on that was for Building 7, that they never really gave a sincere investigation into Building 7. Would you agree?
Well, Building 7 poses a particular problem for the government's story, which I think we should mention. The government's explanation for the collapse is that somehow the combination of the airplane shaking the building and these not very hot fires softening and weakening the steel caused some of the external the perimeter columns to droop inside,
right,
and the horizontal columns to sag and then eventually collapse, and then in a kind of unbelievably fast succession of collapsing floors fall to the ground, which,
right,
it's just an incredible story. And it brings to mind that what is Occam's razor, the theory that when you have a phenomena and you have a rather simple theory that explains all the observable facts about that phenomena, that's probably true,
mm-hmm,
and which would be the controlled demolition theory. And the government keeps straining for a really incredible theory. And when it came to the Building 7, they didn't have anything. In fact, FEMA, which came out with the first analysis, said that their own theory about why the World Trade Center collapsed had a very low probability of being true with respect,
right,
to Building 7. Well, and then they stopped there. They said, well, that's good enough for us, I guess.
Yeah. Like the old adage was, it when in North America and you hear hoofbeats, think horses before zebras. You know, they clearly went and say, well, no, I just couldn't possibly be horses here.
You know, Gus, sometimes I think of this, if this were a TV show, if this was one of the NCI shows,
yeah,
and you had these facts before you, you would have dismissed the government's theory probably by the first or the second commercial. It would be gone. It would be gone. But unfortunately, they're in control of the horizontal and the vertical. They're able to cart away the evidence, and they're able to manufacture reports. And then a supportive mass media is able to, give them sort of a credibility. I should say, though, that while the corporate media is pretty much blacked out the information that we're discussing tonight, there are some sources that have not, independent sources. And one I'd like to commend to our listeners is a newspaper called the Rock Creek Free Press in Washington, D.C., a monthly that's done a lot of 9/11, great 9/11 coverage. And Ken Dowd's show, New World Notes, up at WWUH in West Hartford.
Another newspaper, it's a biweekly, is the American Free Press. And I think they are printed in Florida. And
Formerly known as Spotlight, right?
They're an offshoot of that. Yeah, their lead reporter is Jim Tucker.
Yes,
and he reports from the Bilderberg Conference every year. And
he's
an old surly guy, and he won't take no for an answer, apparently. But one of the other points I wanted to just bring up really quickly on Building 7 was that the eyewitness testimony of the shockwave ripping through the building, he describes it that it goes, you know, all over the place. And the building comes down symmetrically and nice and neat. And the official NISTIC explanation was that it was the boiler, or it was the diesel tank, the oil tank.
Yes.
And it was on one side of the building. So if it exploded, why didn't just one corner come down?
So why do
apparently there's ghosts in the machine tonight.
Why don't we open the phones for some of our listeners to weigh in on this question? Our call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And you're listening to In Context with Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantavero. And we're talking about the collapse of the World Trade Center. Specifically, was it a controlled demolition? And so we've been reviewing some of the evidence in that regard. So if you'd like to give us a ring tonight and give us your opinion on it or your analysis or ask any questions, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Now, we got a couple other short clips, and they're basically just demonstrations of the audio, of the sounds that were heard on that day. And Dave, if we could hear track 4, please.
Maybe.
This is Tower 2 actually collapsing as it came down. What we're listening for specifically in the sound is the sequential popping noise. It's pop, 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 pop. It's very quick, and it's too fast for the floor supposedly pancaking. We're going to switch decks here. Maybe we can get what we need. But anyway... and then after that, we've got the actual sound from a newly surfaced video just about a year ago or so. And that one was of Building 7, and there were firemen that were congregated around a payphone, and they were calling their families to just let everyone know that they were alive, they were safe, everything was okay. And there's just video of them kind of just taking a breather. And while they're talking, all of a sudden, there's just this massive explosion. And then one of the policemen comes running up and says, "Everybody, you got to get back because it might come down." And this is 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
I think he says, as I recall that clip, he says that building is going to come down.
He's
going to,
yeah.
He said it's going, which was bizarre because how could anyone know? One of the things that amazed me is that it took litigation to get the transcripts of the firemen's interviews. The New York Times had to litigate, which, again, you see a consistent pattern here of the government suppressing evidence. And that always sends a red flag up to me, is when there is not a sincere search for the truth on the part of the government. They hide the evidence. They propound preposterous theories. Do we have a caller? No. We have preposterous theories. And there's no effort. There's no effort to bring in these good independent research and to try to give it an objective analysis.
You just reminded me of something. There was a Freedom of Information decision or something, I think it was by the Department of Homeland Security. And the measure was for the purpose of denying Freedom of Information Act requests that dealt with issues of national security. And that was passed or affected in early 2002 because everyone was trying to get these. You know, this information that was coming through, or from. Apparently, we have some equipment difficulties tonight. Is that a call?
It seems to be a call.
Yeah, this is a call.
Hi, good evening. It's WPKN. You're on the air with Gus and Ken.
Hi, this is Ken from Manchester, Connecticut.
Hi, how are you?
Ken?
Thanks for calling.
Good to talk to you again.
Greg.
I have a couple questions. I thought common sense questions that somebody might ask sometime.
Please.
All right, number one, two of them. Number one, did any military person have his weekend leave canceled or been reprimanded or was demoted or punished in any way for allowing the Pentagon to be smashed by a flying object on 9/11?
You know, I don't have the answer to that. That's a tremendous question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
No. I don't
think so either. So if it happened, it was not very well publicized.
No, I'm pretty sure that nobody was reprimanded for the attack on the Pentagon. I'm pretty sure of that.
And even Condoleezza Rice, remember, reluctantly admitted. She recalled that she'd gotten a memo, Bin Laden determined to attack.
Yeah.
Remember?
Imagine that. You know what? This sounds familiar.
if it didn't have to do with the national tragedy, it would have been
comical. I heard about this someplace before.
Okay, I've got another question.
Go ahead.
Now that according to government, it's been proved that a minor office fire can cause a 47-story steel skyscraper to collapse onto its own footprint,
mm-hmm.
has the building code of the state of New York been revised?
No. I'm pretty sure it hasn't. I wonder if I can also get insurance against collapse of my house just by, like, my fireplace being lit or something.
Well, listen, I love your show, and thank you so much. You're doing a great job.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Okay, great talking to you.
Same here.
We have another call.
Hey, good evening, caller. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Ken. Hello, Gus.
Hello.
Hi.
I just been listening to the show. Doing a phenomenal job, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to say that, you know, it's so funny. There was a quote I found on the Internet quite recently. Unfortunately, it's unattributed, but it says, "History repeats itself because no one was listening the first time." And I think it's kind of apt because, you know, you look at there are several undisputed incidences in history where, you know, known cover-ups, and partly because they were on the losing side.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the Marco Polo Bridge incident in 1937.
What is that about? What was that about? What was the Marco Polo Bridge incident about?
The Marco Polo Bridge incident was basically, in a nutshell, no historian today disputes this as fact. 1937, the Japanese had a desire to expand into southern China. They already had annexed large sections of Manchuria, but they needed a pretext to expand into southern China.
Okay.
So they staged an incident whereby they made it appear that the Chinese forces, the Chinese nationalist forces, had crossed the Marco Polo Bridge and attacked them.
Okay.
And then it gave them the pretext. They lost somewhere upwards of 600 soldiers in the attack,
mm-hmm.
at least according to the Wikipedia statistics. And the Japanese used that as their pretext, you know, acting in self-defense, we've been attacked, as their pretext for invading China. Very similarly towards the, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the Gliwice incident.
Mm-hmm.
In the Polish-German border.
Now, this is 1939 when the World War II began, the pretext for World War II?
Precisely. The Germans dressed up prisoners from the concentration camps in Polish army uniforms and claimed that they had launched an attack on the post. And again, these are incidences by which historians do not debate. And if we go as far back as the Great Fire of Rome, that was in, I believe, 67 A.D., or 64 A.D., I'm sorry, when, according to several historians of the day, including Cassius Dio, the fire was started by the Emperor Nero as a pretext for persecuting the Christians.
So what you're reciting is really many examples of false flag operations.
Right.
We just show this is an ancient technique. I guess it was used for the Gulf of Tonkin, right?
It's a basic
to start the Vietnam War.
It's a basic strategy because I mean it's even in the manuals for captains in the army of how to stage terror, how to stage a false flag attack.
It's such an important call. This is such an important aspect of the 9/11 because if in fact it was a controlled demolition, then you have to look at who had the means, who had the motive.
Well, you have to be able to blame it on somebody. You can't just say, you know, we did it.
Exactly.
We needed to bring it down.
you have to look at who gained, you know, what was the purpose of this false flag operation. And I think, as I see an evolution, caller, in the thinking of people like Professor Griffin, David Ray Griffin, with the beginning, I think, in 2004, he said, it appears to me this may have been a false flag operation.
Yeah.
But now I think there's little question in his mind as he's studied it more and more.
It's hard to imagine it isn't.
To begin the so-called war on terror.
Well, the biggest question, I think this is what people have to ask themselves, especially Americans take a very American-centric view towards history, But if we look at not just our own history, but we look at history throughout the world, there's a pattern here. I mean, there's nothing new in history. You know, history goes on to repeat itself, is the old adage.
There's nothing new in history except to the people who have no idea what's ever happened before, you know, because it's all new to me. I don't have a clue what's happened in history. Then, you know, the average American just has absolutely no grasp of history. There's just nothing there.
Well, I'd like to talk a minute about Colonel Fletcher Prouty. I don't know if you're familiar with him, caller,
yep.
But he was in charge of, by his own account, in charge of assassinations at the Pentagon, an Air Force colonel in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And after he did this job, he went on the talk circuit. I think he started to rethink his position, and he started to write exposés and give interviews. And he said, when you have a situation like this, when someone's assassinated, when a crime is committed of this nature, you really have to look at not just at who had the means and who had the motive, but did policy change and who benefited from that change
right,
of
right,
policy.
Right.
And the one case he focused on a lot was the Kennedy assassination, because he was still in service in the Pentagon when that occurred. And he said, well, as soon as I came back to Washington, and he'd been sent away, they had to get rid of him because he wasn't evidently involved. He came back and he said, I started to get across my desk copies of memos saying, how quickly can we build up to 500,000 troops in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as he documents in one of his books, I think it was the CIA and the Kennedy assassination, excuse me, President Kennedy had signed an order to begin a withdrawal from Vietnam just days before he was assassinated, phased withdrawal. So he said, well, I said, I won't tell you who shot Kennedy, but I think that'll give you a pretty good idea.
And then not only that, but we were talking about stage terror earlier, and we're going to cover this more in depth on the 11th. But Operation Northwoods was something that was approved by the Chiefs of Staff and given to Kennedy for his approval. And Operation Northwoods was a plan to plot and take out stage terror attacks within the United States, killing American civilians and blaming it on the communists as a pretext to jump in and make the Cold War a hot war. And
well, caller, do you think? We appreciate your focusing on this issue and calling in tonight. What do you think it would take to get the corporate media to start to pay attention and give coverage to this?
Oh, we lose our call.
I think our caller's gone.
Yeah, the equipment is just going to hell tonight.
Let me just ask you, Gus. What do you think it would take?
What do I think it would take? You know, I think it would take somebody being caught absolutely just with their pants down, red-handed. I'm going to jump on the other side of the board.
Let me just hold on 1 second, folks, and we are just going to fix up our board. But it is very discouraging when you see how difficult it is to get the corporate media to pay attention to this. And, of course, the government did ostensibly have an investigation of this, the 9/11 Commission, which issued its report on the 22nd of July, 2004, and was said to be the most extensive, the authoritative study. And you look through this commission report, and what did it say about the collapse of the World Trade Center? It said absolutely nothing. This is a key aspect of the investigation. They did absolutely nothing on it. And even after that was over, the chairman of the committee, Tom Kane, and the vice chairman, Lee Hamilton, said that the whole 9/11 commission, now this is the chairman and vice chairman, the 9/11 commission was set up to fail. That's what the chairman says, right? They were so frustrated, Gus, that Kane and Hamilton were so frustrated with the lack of cooperation from the Pentagon and the FAA, their failure to come across with the crucial documents, that they even considered beginning an obstruction of justice investigation against the government. That was the 9/11 Commission. And, of course, famously, former Senator Max Cleland, who was the wounded Vietnam War veteran who served in the Senate, he resigned from the 9/11 Commission before the report came out. He called the report a total scam.
Is there a caller online?
Yes, actually. I'm sorry. I got cut off.
No problem.
Oh, thank you, caller, for coming back.
But, I mean, to answer your question, though, regarding the what it would take to get the media to get the media to pay attention
right.
to it, to be honest, the only reason why we acknowledge the Marco Polo Bridge incident or the Gleiswitz incident or the Reichstag fire as, you know, in false flag operations, if you will, is because they lost the war. So all that it's okay for the media, for academics to acknowledge those as false flag operations. On the other hand, I mean, really,
but it's also the other side too. It's not anything we did.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, there's no... I mean, to this day, we still do not acknowledge... There's disputes over the sinking of the USS Maine, which was the pretext for the Spanish-American War. Historians are now beginning to say that, well, there's a possibility that that may have been a false flag operation. And this is almost 100 years later.
All right, caller, I think we're going to have to let you go. We appreciate you for your
Thank you
your
very
comments.
Much, caller.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Night. You have another caller there, Dave?
Yeah, with Mr. Dialtone calling back again.
What are the aspects that I find? There's so many. This travesty of this investigation of 9/11 has so many interesting aspects to it. The collapse of the building, I think, is a good entry point for listeners because you can go to that movie that you mentioned before, Richard Gage, 9/11,
yeah,
Blueprint for Truth.
And
you see the science of the collapse.
Right.
And it is so clear that the buildings fell down for reasons other than the government said.
Right.
But you start to look at other aspects of it, such as the fact that the hijackers were studying at secure American installations. And I just find the fact that the 9/11 Commission never looked into that. And that was reported in places like the Washington Post right after the attack.
The independent press has had to do everything on 9/11. The government has not even attempted to dig up any truth. And we have a call. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, good evening, caller. Gus and Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't get your show earlier on.
You're forgiven.
I think one of the troubles of the 9/11 with the population at large is that they always want to know, well, who did it?
Yeah.
If you follow what I mean.
Sure.
And what I try to always emphasize when I speak is just staying with the physics, you know, steel melting at 2,700 degrees and the jets burning at 1,900. The photograph of the woman in the jagged scar after the plane that hit the building, they identified her as working at
exactly.
the...
Showing that the heat right. wasn't so great that a person was actually able to be standing in the hole of the plane.
Right. The ejector from the collapse that went, some 600 feet into the Winter Garden.
Uh-huh.
It weighed, it was an object that weighed, 6 tons or 60 tons?
Which, of course, wouldn't happen in a normal building fire.
It was a crossbeam that was blown out and hit the American Express building, I think is what you're talking about.
They don't want to think about it, and then they always want to say, well, who did it? And
what do you think of that question? Is that, at what point, caller, do you get to that question? Are people still at the phase who are studying it that they still need to establish that it was a controlled demolition? At what point do you start moving on?
The population, the bulk at large. Intelligent people can look at this and say, there's something wrong here.
This is fishy, right?
But the intelligent population is not the majority population. I'm not saying that out of elitism. It's just simply the way of it.
Well, they're not getting the information.
Personally,
When you had mentioned about the press... if we look at what happened in this country, like the Telecommunications Act of 92,
mm-hmm.
where they allowed coalesce their grip over radio, television, and print in cities.
That's a very good
point.
And now
we just have, right. Any reporter that wants to report on this will be out of a job if he wants to be in the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm.
You take what we consider to be the progressive or left press, Amy Goodman won't touch this.
That's true. It's been astonishing to me.
Yeah, you've made
Democracy
right.
Now, fabulous show, but she runs from this issue.
She won't even go near it.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because she's afraid of it? Or?
I'm not that impressed with Amy Goodman. I have to say this honestly. I mean, if you listen to her shows and you hear how many are like puff pieces where you spend an hour with an actor or an actress, you don't have other people you can hire.
What do you think of this theory, though, that why she can't confront this is that Amy and a lot of people like her, maybe they can't conceive of how they've been so fooled. That maybe it's just, it doesn't compute.
I have two thoughts on
that. I don't know that one, and as I don't know it,
it's hard to say.
What I might have as a private thought would be baseless.
Yeah.
It just says, the 9/11 Commission is baseless. But there's a fellow, Webster Tarpley. He was on a radio show on, what is that woman from the Pacifica Oakland station?
Okay.
Friday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think I heard this.
Yeah, she has. She comes out with the old, Buffalo Springfield song, There's Something Happening Here.
Right, for what it's worth,
right. And the name eludes me. I know that's terrible, you know, trying to have an intelligent conversation and not naming
it. What did Webster Tarpley say?
Well, Webster Tarpley wrote a book about it, 9/11 Synthetic Homegrown Terror. And he was speaking also to what's going now with this fellow that's in charge of WikiLeaks and speaking
Julian
about...
Julian Assange.
And I thought this myself about the leak. How does a private, I'm not talking about the Apache helicopter film, but how does a private get enough clearance to go and get 90,000 documents?
I believe we've had this conversation before.
I mean, is there a big drawer that has classified documents? I mean, I understand they're on computers, but you have to get them together. You have to collate them. Yes, I know they can be sent out as soon as you push the button, but the actual gathering... What, he just went in there and did like a, Google search?
Right. I mean, that's not so much of an issue to me. I think that staying more on, because I haven't had the issue, well, the chance to really investigate this guy yet.
Tarpley is saying that the fellow in charge of WikiLeaks,
Assange.
I'm terrible with his
language. That's fine. I know what Tarpley's reported on him.
Yeah, he's saying that this man is a stooge.
They're saying he grew up in part of a cult in Australia. His father forced him into a game, mind-altering drugs. One of the symbols of his having blonde hair.
Well, passing
which
that,
now dyed
but
black.
The thing is, the documents, he made a point now, naturally you can't read all the documents, there's 90,000 of
right.
them, but that there's nothing in there that's incriminating, to the very highest echelon.
That's things
government.
We've already known.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Things that, right, there's nothing about that, there's just the wanton slaughter and senseless brutality of villages being wiped out or wedding parties being massacred, which is really nothing. And he's saying that this is being done with another purpose in mind.
Well, that's yet to be seen. But staying on topic
with 9/11
just to bring it back.
Sorry to go far.
Well, but you do mention the war, and Max Cleland said. The senator resigned from the 9/11 commission. He said they had a plan to go to war, and when 9/11 happened, that's what they did. And so, you go back to like Secretary O'Neill's, the Secretary of Treasury, mm-hmm. Treasury Secretary under Bush.
Paul O'Neill.
He said from the first day when Bush came into office, and I'd go into the meetings, and there would be Cheney and Bush, and they were poring over the maps of Iraq, trying to figure out where they put their oil.
Field. Like it's a risk board.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
and so you go back to
the upshot of it. The Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to believe that in a couple of days. They had Senate and congressional aides go out and whip up a, what was it, a 300 or 800 page document?
Right. How did this come out?
It came out that quickly.
Yeah.
And it was voted on before the final version was even posted.
Yeah. And they hadn't read it. Yeah. But how did it get drafted so quickly? How did the invasion of Afghanistan get organized so quickly?
Well,
it's already
done. Another thing, too. One thing they never talk about, and nobody ever says this, who's actually making money? Win, lose, or draw? Who's making money? Now, Afghanistan is landlocked, effectively. You can't get there through Iran. You probably can't get there through the Chinese border. So they have to come up through the stands. But still, that's landlocked in the sense that it would have to come through Russia.
Well, that was about
so
the Afghan war. That was
has to be flown in. Has to be flown in. And who's making the money selling the fuel at whatever exorbitant rates to actually maintain these troops.
But that war was about the pipeline through Afghanistan. That's really what they were pushing for.
Well, that's what they tell us.
Enron, it's a matter of record. Enron wanted the pipeline, and so did that Unocal consortium that was organized of oil companies. And they were pushing the Taliban.
The pipeline. But the thing is, who makes the money from all these Tories,
It always comes down to money. Thank you very much for calling. You've raised a lot of interesting points. Thanks very much.
In a civilized society, greed would be recognized as a psychosis.
Right.
Somebody else, sir.
Thanks very
much
now.
And thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
Good night now.
And, he makes a lot of great points that I've even got on my list here. He talked about the Patriot Act. And I have a list here of side effects that we've gotten from 9/11. And they through extension, have their own, honeycomb of connections of who made money from what and how and why they wanted to be there. We've got the Patriot Act 1 and 2, which gives unlimited powers to spy, detain American citizens, charge citizens without any accountability. We have the Department of Homeland Security, which is the black hole for funding and police state measures. We have the Military Commissions Act, which suspends habeas corpus and expands definition of military combatants, which basically is just anybody that they wish to be an enemy combatant. They find exemptions from the Geneva Convention for the United States government so they can just do anything that they want.
Essentially, it's a permanent state of war.
Right.
And we are allowed to take emergency measures like kidnapping people,
tribunals,
torturing them, secret military tribunals.
But no one ever finds out what the evidence is until you go stand up in front of them and they show it to you. Your lawyer is not allowed to see the evidence.
And then they present someone and they say, oh, this is the mastermind of the 9/11. You find out the man was waterboarded. He was tortured 83 times in 1 month.
Yeah, overall it was like 190 times he was waterboarded, and he admitted to bombing things that were built 4 years after he was arrested.
Well, you know, it comes back to a theme that
Khalid
I think
Sheikh
we've
Mohammed
developed
we're talking
in
about.
History counts, and we're going to keep going after and in context, which
right.
is the connection between a war and the erosion of our country in terms of our economy, in terms of our civil liberties. You know, Martin Luther King said you can't have justice without peace, and it's absolutely true. The wars of this nation have enslaved us in debt. It caused us to run up these huge national debts, which are crushing the American people with debt. It's depriving us of much-needed investments to make this country competitive, to build up our economy. And it's also giving the pretext for destroying our civil rights. So you really need to find the truth, and that's what we're after in this series in context. We're trying to find the truth. We want to build a more prosperous America, America that's based on peace and justice.
Right. Just like that quote you just said is tremendous, because there is no justice during war, because you have to just you can't sort everything out while you're in the middle of the fray. The idea is to just, well, lock everybody up and we'll figure it out later after the shooting's done. But when the shooting never stops, how do you ever figure out who's innocent?
That's right. And
how many people are on the terror watch list and no fly list and can never get off?
And ladies and gentlemen, this struggle to end war and for the you know, to improve this country, make it more prosperous and free, is not a left issue. It's not a right issue.
Absolutely.
It belongs to every American who values democracy and freedom. And I'm afraid that's
human
it.
Life.
That's it for this edition of In Context. You've been listening to In Context with Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Condavaro. And we'll continue this conversation this Saturday, the anniversary of 9/11. We'll talk more about 9/11 and have some interesting clips. And we're going to have the opportunity to have a three-hour program for you early birds. That's this Saturday from 6 to 9 a.m. in the morning. And that show is going to take place during WPKN's fall, which begins on Tuesday. And during that morning, we'll be offering an outstanding premium, which we've developed, called From JFK to 9/11, which includes several of our History Counts shows, a book, and some special mixes that our general manager, Peter Beauchamp, has created on 9/11 and the assassination of JFK, for those who were able to make a contribution. And we really thank you, listeners, for supporting WPKN. The information you heard tonight, you're not hearing on the networks. You're not hearing it on most outlets. But you do hear it on PKN, and we only because you listeners support this station. We don't have corporate underwriting. We don't have advertisers that we depend on. We count on you, and we thank you very much for your support. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and please visit us online at incontextreport.com, where you can see some interesting videos that we have on 9/11 and some blogs that we've written. So thanks for joining us, and please stay tuned for the remainder of Dave Schwartz's show right here on
whatever's left is pancaking
WPKN.
As we speak.
89.5 FM.
We have an important news break, Ken, coming up. It's hold on 1 second. Something coming over the AP. Well, that was Pete Seeger. No, it's not Pete Seeger.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
There you go. There you go, Ken.
Thank you very much.
So, you going to do anything new on your birthday year? Anything coming up on...
This coming year?
Yeah.
Well, just keep on trucking on.
The doctor of democracy turns...
I'm getting into serious count on my age here.
I didn't
but
even know.
But there are only two candles on the cake, so well, I guess we'll have to multiply by a large number.
Yeah, it's a binary cake.
It is indeed. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Ken. So, any birthday wishes for WPKN or for yourself?
Just peace.
Just peace. Peace right,
well,
is good.
Pass me a piece of cake, and you're going to be back on Saturday. Back on Saturday?
Saturday from 6 to 9. Gus and I will be here for the fundraiser with our show from JFK to 9/11.
40-ounce coffee mugs.
And we're going to have some birthday cake with Ken, and I'll be back in a moment or two with some fresh, old folk music.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.